When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of November, 2025, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, mulling over some of the news from the industry in the past couple of weeks. Have you got your Christmas decorations up yet, Phil?
No.
Well, I asked because I've just had a press release from somebody going on about something to do with interior design and getting ahead of the curve and telling me that I ought to get my my interior decor ready for the festive season. Seems indecently early to me.
Well, all the Christmas ads are already on the TV, all the supermarket ads.
Oh, are they?
Whatever. They've already started. Mm. But that's what happens as soon as Halloween's out. In fact, sometimes as soon as Easter's out of the way. But certainly as soon as Halloween's out of the way, it's no long Christmas.
Oh, well. We're not going to talk about Christmas, are we?
No, we're not.
Not for a couple of weeks, anyway.
No, I tell you what, I think we'd like to start off talking, well, sort of briefly about COP30. Is a big meeting going on in the Amazon jungle in the north of Brazil. Is that an annual thing, this conference of the parties?
I don't know.
The United Nations.
Was it COP26 they had up in Glasgow?
No, it must have been
COP29.
COP29 must have been last year's one, because it's COP30 this time, but there was one in Glasgow.
Well, maybe it is annual, I don't know. But, I mean, I only noticed the COP one up in Scotland, because, of course, it was in the UK, and can't remember who the government minister was who was backing it all. But it was all over the news back then. But I haven't really heard any COP news since, until this one, of course.
Alok Sharma, the Tory minister who was sort of
moved sideways by
Theresa. Was it 2016? I thought it was when Theresa May was prime minister. Sorry, 2020.
Oh, I can't remember. Anyway,
whatever.
This one's in Brazil, far more exotic.
Yes. The Americans aren't there.
No.
And I'm not sure that... Are the Chinese there?
Well, I looked this morning and they are sending a delegation, but Xi Jinping isn't going, or anybody senior. And I don't think the United States is sending anybody, because, of course, it's not what they're interested in anymore in the United States. It's all rather sort of yesterday's news. Not fake news, but yesterday's news.
Well, we'll come on to that in a minute, actually, because that relates to something else that we've... The Construction Index. I haven't reported on COP30. I haven't found a specific construction angle, but, of course, it's relevant what they decide on, how the world is moving towards tackling global warming and so on, is all significant. But it all seems... Well, two things. One, it's incremental. Each year they get together and they might agree a tiny bit, but you don't seem to get the sort of the big groundbreaking move forward on what people are going to do. But then, do we want that? You know, what is there that we want in them? Some sort of revolution?
Well, I don't know. It's all about reducing global warming, sort of combating global warming. And as you say, you know, that we have the occasional sort of landmark agreement. You know, the Paris Agreement is, I think, the most current one. There was a Kyoto Protocol many, many years ago. I can't, for the life of me, remember what the gist of it all was. But, I mean, it all comes down to reducing carbon emissions and preventing global warming and that kind of thing. And I don't know if you noticed, Phil, but this morning, apparently a lot of indigenous Brazilians, Amazonians...
I saw that.
...stormed the COP meeting. You know, they were pretty angry, which I thought was ironic, really, seeing as a whole event is supposed to be trying to reduce carbon emissions and deforestation. And you know, basically doing what the indigenous people would want them to do, stop mining, stop
oil and gas. Up to a point, they did build a huge, great, wide superhighway through the jungles to get so that the dignitaries of the world could, you know, get off their jets and drive to the COP hotel, their COP hotels, at speed and comfort. So that there's actually been deforestation for the event, as far as as far as reports I've read make out. And it's an awful lot of airplane trips. I don't know how many, you know, what the carbon footprint is of the COP delegates going to the event. And you wonder, couldn't they, you know, do it by Zoom?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they should. It wouldn't be as cozy and as exciting or exotic if they did it via Zoom from their own offices. But, I mean, I suppose the problem is that Brazil isn't really near anywhere except the rest of South America. Maybe you can hop down from North America, although as we've already...
But New York isn't near anywhere except Canada.
No, that's true. Yeah, that's
I mean, everywhere thinks it's the centre of the world and the other side of the world is nowhere. I mean, you know, in many ways, Brazil is the centre of the world.
Yeah.
Don't ask me to name them, but I'm sure...
But it does seem strange. I always feel slightly cynical when I read about you know, all the great and the good spouting all this sort of pious stuff about global warming and then jumping onto a private jet to go over to somewhere like Davos to tell everybody about how they need to pull their finger out and reduce global warming. It all seems a little bit insincere to me. But maybe I'm just getting a bit tired of the whole thing. I don't know about you, but we're still being told the same message time and time again, and apparently we're not doing enough about it.
Well, this leads on nicely to a report from RICS, Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, this week, the RICS 2025 Sustainability Report. This is an international report based on input from more than 3,500 real estate and construction professionals from 36 countries. And it is basically saying, warning that momentum behind sustainable development risks stalling. There seems to be a slight tapering of interest and enthusiasm in the whole thing. And this is in large part attributed to, is it leadership or lack of a leadership from the Americans, specifically the USA?
Yeah.
Donald Trump is not the president of the USA at the moment, if anyone has not been paying attention. But he is not particularly excited by the whole green agenda. And this report, I'm just trying to find out what some of the contents of it. 46% of construction professionals report not measuring embedded carbon, and that figure has gone
embodied carbon. Yeah.
Sorry, embodied carbon.
I don't know the difference. Embodied and embedded, I imagine, it probably amounts to the same thing.
But the fact is that fewer construction professionals are going through the process of measuring carbon. Only 16% say carbon measurement meaningly informs material choices in project design. I think the reason why RICS is particularly interested in this bit is that I think they're either involved in or they have some sort of tool for measuring carbon that they want the world to get behind. And presumably then they can, you know, rather like when this issue of civil engineers has its, you know, new engineering contract, form of contract, they want to promote that because they'll sell copies of it. And presumably RICS can make money from
or
selling
BREEAM,
system. Yeah. Yeah. And BREEAM is not RICS, that's a building research establishment.
Yeah, but sure,
One of those sort of things. It can be, will be, maybe already is a money spinner for RICS. So they want governments in general to introduce mandatory whole life carbon reporting for all construction projects. And, you know, preferably our measurement tools, please, since we're the profession that does the counting of things on site.
Yeah. I mean, it's understandable they should take that stance. But then you see, for a long time now, I mean, for at least a decade, probably two, environmental concerns have been at the top of the construction agenda. you know, along with the perennials like the lack of women and ethnic minorities in the industry and health and safety, of course. But the environmental agenda is and has been such an important thing, and everybody's talking about it. And I just wonder, I mean, I just said myself that I'm getting a bit tired of being told I've got to reduce my carbon footprint every time somebody opens their mouth. And I just wonder if other people are just feeling, oh, we've heard this time and time again. Why are they still banging on about it? Haven't we done enough? And maybe
it just seems to be another box to be ticked, though.
There is always that, yeah. Because it
is this requirement.
I was going to say it's a sort of a way of virtue signalling, and has been for a long time in the construction industry.
I'd argue it's moved on from virtue signalling in the same way that, you know, 10-20 years ago, people might have said we've, you know, given money to this local charity as a virtue signalling thing. Now it's actually almost always a contractual requirement to not just virtue signal, but to do something virtuous. You have to demonstrate biodiversity net gain. We've talked about that in the past, the BNG requirements. And most public sector clients, all public sector clients, as far as I can see, require you to demonstrate your social value, which has become, we talked about this before, a frankly ludicrous hijacked industry, which has just pushed up costs. Now, people haven't started to ask the question about how damaging the social value agenda is to the UK economy. I mean, it's great that good works are being done, but it corrupts the efficiency drive that should be front and centre of anyone building anything.
Yeah.
The BNG, the environmental thing, people are starting to ask. I mean, maybe some sort of the Farage type people, or the politically right wing, I should say. I don't mean politically right, correct, as in not wrong. isn't it weird? Right and correct are synonyms, but politically right and politically correct are not. Anyway, where's it going? Yeah, I think that there have been. I mean, even, you know, the current Labour government have started to say, to what extent are we, you know, putting the environmental cart before the horse? And Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves themselves have said, you know, no more £100 million bat nut tunnels, and we're not going to let newts stop housing development anymore.
No.
And so there is actually, wrong to attribute to the right, it's a fairly, you know, front centre mainstream, starting to, let's put the whole environmental agenda into some sort of context where we still, given that we need economic growth, we cannot let environmental protection stifle economic growth.
I think that's probably it. I think people are beginning to realise that the cost of achieving our sort of 2050 carbon reduction target is going to be extremely expensive. And we're beginning to see that other economies are overtaking our own, and that we're putting ourselves at an economic disadvantage by doing this. Of course, the counter argument is that, you know, we need to lead by example, and that if we don't do it, we can't expect other people to do it. So, you know, we're sort of caught in a bit of a bind there. But I think that there is a growing acceptance that the cost, we have to address the cost issue here. And I think that's certainly why the government has soft-pedaled slightly on this, you know, with the bat tunnels and the newts and all the rest of it. And as you said, you know, the elephant in the room, of course, is Donald Trump, because he's been completely unequivocal about his opposition to this sort of green agenda. You know, one of his rallying cries before the last presidential election was drill, baby, drill, you know, and he makes no secret of the fact that, as far as he's concerned, he wants to exploit all the fossil fuels that the United States can get its hands on. And I think, you know, clearly if the president of the United States is taking that stance, the effect is going to ripple out, isn't it? And it's going to have a chilling effect on the whole sort of carbon reduction lobby.
Yes, it'd be interesting to see what comes out of the whole COP30 thing, you know, without the Americans there, or at least without Trump there, whether we'll have the same momentum. But there are other ways in which, you know, more sort of close to home ways in which the green thing seems to be losing momentum. I mean, the shift to electric vehicles, for example, mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be happening as quickly as had been anticipated, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. The uptake of heat pumps has improved a lot, but it's not quite got the momentum that, you know, 5 years ago we were promised it would have. And there's a report last week from an insurance company, QBE, a business insurance insurer, saying that the growth of solar panels has led to, or solar panel installations on buildings, has led to an even greater incidence of solar panels catching fire. And that's going to put people off, I think, the idea, of having solar panels. Oh, I don't want solar panels if they're going to catch fire. But as you
said, that's an interesting story, because I think if you read that story, it becomes clear that it's not necessarily that solar panels are dangerous or they're always going to catch fire. It's the haste at which we're trying to adopt this technology, and the fact that it's lack of maintenance, poor installation, that kind of thing, is actually creating the fire risk. As you say, the incidence of fire has increased more than the actual rate of adoption.
Installation.
Installation. So I think that's a clear sign. Yeah, isn't it twice the rate of new installations over the past 2 years, it says. But I think it's very telling that the figures that they quote here is that last year, that's 2024, there were 151 fires associated with solar, photovoltaic panels. But of those, 97 were on residential buildings, 27 on commercial properties, 17 on solar farms, and 10 on industrial buildings. So the vast majority were on residential buildings. And I think that's homeowners, the proliferation of solar installers for the domestic market, people perhaps who have seen an opportunity to become a solar panel installer, maybe they're a roofing contractor, and gone in there, you know, saying we can fit these panels for you because we're good at working on roofs, but haven't really had the experience or the knowledge of how to actually install them correctly. So I think that's the sort of thing. I don't think it's a systemic problem. I think it will correct itself. But as you point out, I think it could act as a disincentive for anybody considering doing it themselves.
I think you're right. What it should, of course, do is act as a disincentive for, I mean, homeowners are, I've been guilty of it myself, are much more prone to get the cheapest bid, especially the one without VAT on top, than perhaps, an industrial customer, a B2B customer. And therefore, they're going to be more vulnerable to the slightly less competent or less thorough installer. I think that the lesson is not don't get solar panels, it's get someone, make sure that the person you're getting knows what they're doing.
Yes, yeah, I think that's exactly it. But yeah, again, that's just another example of, I don't know, how people might be falling out of love with some of this technology and the need to reduce their carbon footprint.
Have you got an electric car?
No, I haven't.
Are you interested in electric cars?
I wouldn't buy one, put it that way.
That's because you live miles from anywhere. You'd have range anxiety going anywhere, wouldn't you?
Well, probably, but also, I think that, I don't know, I think that there is an environmental argument to do what I do, which is always buy a second-hand car. I mean, I bought a new car once, but I just can't see the point, partly because of the depreciation. But there are all those diesel and petrol cars out there. Let's use those up first before we start buying the electric cars. I don't know. I think there's nothing wrong with electric cars. And if you think about it, our assumption is that they're a bit wacky, a bit odd. But actually, an electric car makes an awful lot of sense. You don't have to burn fuel. You just sort of plug it in, top it up. You don't have all those moving parts whizzing around underneath your bonnet. It's scientifically a better option, I think. But not for me, not just yet, anyway. What about you?
Well, I've got a half decent 10-year-old German car, which I hope has got another 10 years on it. I plan to drive it into the ground and see where we are then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we can all do our bit, I suppose, but you know, I'm not interested in getting an electric car. I'm not interested in having solar panels on my roof. I'm not interested in getting a heat pump to heat my house. But that's partly because my house leaks energy like a sieve, and a heat pump and a solar panel probably wouldn't touch the sides, quite honestly.
Well, I am slightly interested in solar panels, because when we moved aboard our house 26 years ago, at the time the survey said, keep an eye on the roof. It's probably good for another 10 years, but... and I've had occasional running repairs done, it's on and off over the time, and people always said, yeah, you're probably good for another, you know, probably another good for another 10 years. We'll just fix this, you know, replace this slipped tile. So yeah. I'm aware that they can't keep saying that. So if and when I do need to retile the roof, it might be an opportune moment to think about getting, you know, solar, some of those embedded solar tile type things in there.
Well, I missed that opportunity. I had a new roof last year, and they're just terracotta tiles, I'm afraid. Nothing photovoltaic up there. But
I will explore it. I'll see what's in the kitty, if anything.
Yeah, mind you, Phil, you probably don't need to put any panels on your roof, because you've got in the grand scheme of things, your roof is tiny, and they're probably going to put a massive 10-hectare solar farm somewhere on the outskirts of Maidstone soon, and that can be your contribution to the renewable energy economy.
Do you know what? There's actually a field right next door to my house. It's sort of at the level of I've got a bank at one side of my house, and there used to be orchards, and the apple trees have all been pulled out a decade ago because there's no money in apples anymore for the farmers, and that's just been sitting there, and it's too many fields away from where all the house building is going on, but that might be ripe for a solar farm, I fear.
Yeah, keep your eye on it.
Do they hum? Do solar panels hum?
I don't think they do. I mean, as far as I'm aware, there aren't any moving parts. There might be, going back to this report from QBE or whatever the organisation was, about these solar panel fires, one of the problems is overheating. Well, I suppose it's pretty obvious that overheating would cause a fire. And battery storage is an issue, because, of course, people are now installing not just the solar panels, but also batteries in order to store the energy that they generate during the daylight
hours.
You'd
want that. That's sensible.
And as we know, lithium batteries, lithium ion batteries, if they do go wrong, they go wrong quite spectacularly, and they are prone to fire if they're overcharged or they're charged with the wrong sort of charger or something like that. So there might be some cooling fans whizzing around. I don't know. But
and they're probably Chinese and spying on you as well.
Probably. But I don't suppose it would be any louder than, say, a gas boiler firing up. And we're quite used to that sort of noise, aren't we?
Yes, indeed. Have we exhausted sustainability?
I think so. I mean, I would just go back to where we started and that Rick's study, because they conclude at the end that that the report shows clear signs of fatigue and uncertainty, which I think, you know, sums up the hot air that we've been spouting for the last few minutes. I also noticed that Greta Thunberg herself seems to have moved on to other issues recently.
I noticed that. She doesn't get, well, forgive me, I was about to say she doesn't care about the plant anymore. That's absolutely untrue thing to say.
I'm sure if you asked her, she would.
But she's waving different flags currently.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So again, maybe just the attention is shifting.
Yes.
So let's find another topic to talk about, Phil.
So I'm just thinking, poor old Greta. You're blaming Greta Thunberg.
I wouldn't want to get fatigue on the wrong and uncertainty. Side of it. No, maybe she's suffering from it. Yeah, poor girl. I mean, she's only young. Yeah, as I was about to say, I wouldn't get on the wrong side of her, but because she's a force to be reckoned with. But yeah.
But anyway, we need time's moving on. We've been talking too long. Yeah, we haven't got all day. I want to talk about a complete change of subject, and I don't quite know where I'm going with this, but I find it interesting that in the general, maybe it started when Tony Blair said he wanted everyone or 50% of school leavers to go to university. And we can trace it back to that. We can trace it back in the construction industry to the start of the CPCS scheme and CS, you know, the competence cards, construction skills competency scheme. And the idea is that whatever your trade on site, you should have a card that says you're qualified. You're competent, and here's your certificate of competence that you know what you're doing. And we're moving beyond that to, it seems to me, to what are traditionally very much considered trades within the construction industry, moving towards or seeking to move towards professions, the professionalisation of trades. We had a piece of news just a couple of weeks ago that the Chartered Institute of Building, the CIOB, which is the body through which building managers, rather than builders per se, but builders in the sort of, you know, building bosses sense, can have a professional qualification. They're a chartered builder if they're a member of the Chartered Institute of Building. And they're now offering a route in collaboration with the National Federation of Roofing Contractors for roofing trades. They use the term experienced roofing professionals, but actually I would say they're roofing people in the roofing trade can achieve chartered status and become a member of the Chartered Institute of Building. Now, whether they become a chartered roofer or a chartered builder is not entirely clear to me, but the idea that a roofer, is going to have chartered status is interesting, and possibly in the grand scheme of things, in 20 years' time, we might think, was that wise? In the same way that now we look back at the grade inflation, and the degree becomes, I don't want to say meaningless. It's not meaningless. But it has a lot less value if 50% of your cohort have a degree. If you're one of 10%, you're obviously, more qualified or at least you differentiate yourself. Now, it's great that everyone has the opportunity and so on and so forth. But I think there's, when Tony Blair said we want 50% of the university of school leavers go to university, very few people would come out and say, oh, that's a bad thing. We don't think these people should be allowed to go to university, blah, blah, blah. The general theme was, yes, everyone should have the opportunity. If they're smart enough, if they get their A-levels, they should be allowed to go. But we've seen what happens. Suddenly you've got, a million people doing media studies and no one doing plumbing and apprentices and trades and boots on the ground kind of jobs that need doing. No one wants to be blue collar anymore. Everyone wants to be white collar. Coupled with the same sort of story, the roofing contractors tying up the CIOB, there was a piece last month, the Metal Cladding and Roofing Manufacturers Association, which is the trade association of companies, of contractors, they've launched the Metal Cladding and Roofing Institute. This is all in response to the post-Grenfell building safety agenda. But the Metal Cladding and Roofing Institute is for individuals rather than for companies. And they're developing or plan to develop training modules. So that you there'll be some sort of competency qualification so that they're not offering or no suggestion at this stage you'd be certified but you become in some way a qualified cladder metal roofing installer or whatever it is. So it's the whole idea of giving qualifications to people who earn them, people who can benefit from having them, and so on and so forth, and that's all a good thing. And yet,
I can hear a butt coming.
This is what is in my mind. You've got the traditional trade seeking to become professions, and I mentioned to you that I was in my local pub 10 days, a couple of weeks ago, and chatting to who regularly pops up the bar, who's like me in his 60s. And I said, you know, you still work, you give me up work. He said, yeah, I don't want to give up work. Work for myself. I'm enjoying. He's an architect. Mm-hmm. He says, but bloody ARB, I'm not giving them any more money. I said, why not? I said, it's all this CPD stuff. I don't need to do it. CPD, construction, continuing professional development. He says, I don't need to do CPD. If I don't know it already at my age, I shouldn't have been doing it for the past 40 years. You know. Basically, he says, there's now no one can tell me anything because I know it all. And so he'll carry on, you know, doing the work that he does as an architect, you know, submitting planning applications for people and fairly, you know, routine domestic stuff that pays the bills. And I said, but surely you need to keep on top of things as an architect. I mean, you know, what about all the post-Grenfell cladding implications? This, I don't use cladding. I've never put cladding on any of my buildings. I said, but there must be, you know, there are always changes in technology and legislation. He says, no, not what I do. I don't need it. So anyway, to save himself 250 quid and the pain of filling in his CPD form or doing CPD, he's decided to cancel his or not renew his ARB subscription, and he's not bothering with his RIBA membership either. So clearly,
so does that mean that he's no longer an architect?
He can no longer call himself an architect. Well, I think he can still call himself an architect technician or something like that.
Okay.
But he's simply saying the burden of what is required to maintain my professional status, CPD, I don't see it as valuable or useful. I don't want to do it. It's a waste of time. It's stupid. It's just a money-making machine. It's not going to make me any better in my job. I'm not going to do it. And therefore, he forgoes his professional status.
Yeah.
And with this whole drive at the trade side of the industry to be, you know, get a professional qualification, become professional, and at the top end, forgive me, I don't mean the top end, the professional end, architects, and architects certainly do see themselves at the top of the tree in the construction sphere universe. And it seems to be, it's not just this one architect. I had a firm of lawyers pitching an article suggestion thing, and I might well be receiving it soon, so I might be seeing it on Construction Index website before too long. And their point was very much the same, that there's an awful lot of architects reluctant to engage in the whole CPD process. Architects are not maintaining their knowledge in the way that they need to, and this is causing gaps in delays in projects, shortages of people who know what they're doing. And I wonder whether in 30 years' time, all these chartered roofers will suddenly think, well, maybe not suddenly, but gradually have come to the realisation, hang on, you want me to do what? Continuing professional development just to bang nails into tiles, which I've been doing for 40 years. I've got to do CPD and fill in a form explaining all the learning that I've done. So it certainly seems to be, for those who go through CPD, it certainly seems to be controversial. Although I do have another chum in the local pub who is a surveyor, an RACS member. We mentioned him already today. He's in his 70s and still working for himself, a lot of, you know, party wall type stuff and old buildings and listed building type stuff. And he loves his CPD. He's all over it. And every time he says, oh, I was on this great seminar. And they have these sort of luncheon clubs where they meet up in some pub for a grand lunch, and someone who's might be a lawyer or a professor or someone who's up on the latest speed of some development will give them a half-hour talk or whatever it is on what's going on in this sphere or something of interest that they might learn something from. And, 5 hours later, they finish their lunch.
I think it's no coincidence that those two professionals that you've just described are both more than 60. They're towards the end of their careers. And I think that it's interesting to see those two sort of diametrically opposed attitudes. I mean, the first chap, the architect, he's probably been doing the same thing day in, day out for the last 30 or 40 years. And you know, there's no variety in what he does. He's just basically going through the motions. And perhaps, you know, his the business of architecture is no longer holds any fascination for him. You know, maybe he's more interested in going out and spending a day on a golf course or something like that, or just, you know, having a city break somewhere. Whereas your surveyor, perhaps he became a surveyor because he was, you know, inspired by the profession and the built environment. And that fascination has never actually waned. He's still interested in it. And you know, his lunch clubs and stuff like that. I mean, he's 70 years old. He can go out, he can socialize. It gives him a reason to get out of the house. He can go and learn something. He's still learning. I think that's entirely understandable. What I think is hard to understand, and I'm not quite sure whether or not this is actually the situation, is whether or not people at the other end of their careers, people who are just starting out as an architect or a surveyor, or perhaps people who are sort of, you know, in full swing, maybe they're in their 40s and, you know, they are, if you like, as senior as they're going to become, whether or not they are the ones who are getting jaded with the idea of a CPD course and they don't want to do it anymore. Because I think if that's the case, then we have got a problem. Because clearly you need to keep abreast of developments. And if you're going to be working as an architect or a surveyor for another 20 years or so, you cannot afford to get behind the curve. I mean, my daughter, she's now 31. She is a chartered surveyor. She loves her CPD, and not only that, she's absolutely determined that she's going to get everything she can out of it, because it means, well, it's professional development. It, you know, it says what it does, what it says on the tin. She's ambitious. She wants to get ahead, and she wants to keep ahead of the curve. And you know, who can blame her? If she was feeling so so jaded with the profession and with her work that she was no longer interested, then that would be a problem. You know, she would just, I suppose, just vegetate, or she'd have to go and find another job and do something that she was interested in. So I think that CPD is, you know, you get out of it what you want to get out of it.
But I suppose my concluding thought on all this is I would think it's a positive thing to always want to learn, whatever age you are. You know, even if you're, you know, 80, taking up a new language or whatever, wanting to learn, being interested enough to learn, is always positive, whether it's directly related to your job or not, or if you're retired. And if not wanting to learn or not wanting to exercise the mind is conversely, you know, a less desirable, not desirable. I don't want to say it's a bad thing. Well, okay, it's a bad thing.
it's a slippery slope. When you get to our age, Phil, if you lose interest in things, then that's it. There's only, you're only going in one direction.
But it does make me think I need to start reading more. I need to read more books. since I got an iPad, whatever, 10 years ago, I don't seem to read books like I used to, not even on that. So I need to go back to that. Yeah. Anyway, so that's CPD, love it or hate it, it's good.
Yeah, I think it probably is.
I think we should award CPD points for anyone who's got to this stage of listening.
We should do, really.
Is this a CPD accredited event?
No, unfortunately,
how do we make that?
But I think that anybody who actually, you know, sort of sits it out and listens to the whole podcast deserves something. Our gratitude, maybe that will do.
Hopefully that's enough. Finally, there's a debate in the House of Commons. I don't think it's in the main chamber, I think it's in Westminster Hall. And it's one of these, what do they call it, after something debates.
Oh, yes, I think I know what you mean.
I've got the email somewhere, I haven't got it. But the Federation of Master Builders tipped us the wing, said, do tune in to, you know, House of Commons TV Live or whatever it is. They're debating, I don't know whether it's specifically cowboy builders or specifically proposals for a licensing scheme for builders, which is designed to combat or to eradicate cowboy builders. We've mentioned before the Federation of Master Builders is terribly keen on creating a barrier to entry for companies in the building business, and it thinks that people should have to pay money for a license and go through a rigmarole to prove their competence. Not just companies, but individual sole trader builders will all have to jump through hoops and pay money to have a license, a bit like dogs used to have to. And Mark Garner, MP, is the chap who's leading this for the Federation of Master Builders. And I'll be interested to see if there's a single MP who agrees with me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. So, this has been rumbling on for a long time, hasn't it? This business about licensing builders. And again, it grew out of the Grenfell tragedy.
No, it predates that. Coming out of Grenfell, they were saying that Tier 1 contractor, you shouldn't be allowed to put cladding on, or you shouldn't be allowed to put up a tall building without a licence. And the government said, OK, well, you know, we've undertaken to accept every recommendation of the official inquiry into the Grenfell fire, so we'll look at that. So there's one thing in the works for having, you know, your Balfour Beatties will have to have a licence, because you know, only that way will Balfour Beatty know what they're doing if they have a license. On the second scale of that is the chap I, you know, the local jobbing builder who's going to repoint my patio or put a little extension on my house or whatever. He will have to have, or she will have to have, a license to demonstrate that they're competent. So at the top end and the bottom end, there are big campaigns for licensing. At the bottom end, it's about getting rid of cowboys and rogue builders. At the top end, it's stopping Grenfell Tower from burning down. Neither will make the slightest bit of difference, as I've gone on at length before. And there are probably people in the work saying that other people, that maybe demolition contractors should have to have a licence, because what they do is special. And then you have to say, well, what's demolition? If I'm taking down my... Anyway. We've had this discussion before. Maybe we'll do it again. But I'd be interested to see what the MPs have to say and whether I can spot a sensible one that I agree with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's happening tomorrow, you say.
It is. I don't know what time, but feel free to Google it. Actually, if you hang on, I've probably got the email somewhere. So, debate on rogue builders... it will take place in Westminster Hall on Thursday, 13th of November. It can be watched live on Parliament TV. It doesn't say what time in this email. I suspect it's probably 3:30, something like that. But I suggest if you are interested, you check earlier than that. Yeah. It'll be available afterwards. You don't have to watch it live. You can catch it later.
Can't wait.
Right. Other than that... I think it's goodbye from professionally unqualified me.
And from professionally unqualified me too.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.